On this episode of Piano Jazz, we revisit the 1994 archives to bring you a program with lyricist, composer Stephen Sondheim as Marianne McPartland's guest. At that time, Sondheim had already enjoyed more than 35 years of a successful career in writing for theater and film. Stephen demonstrated his musical abilities as a child when he started taking piano lessons. At the age of 10, he became friends with a neighbor, Jimmy Hammerstein, whose father happened to be one half of the famous musical playwright duo of Rodgers and Hammerstein. It was during this friendship and for many years that Sondheim was mentored by Oscar Hammerstein. Although he aspired to write music and the lyrics, his earliest successes were from lyric writing assignments for musicals such as West Side Story and Gypsy. Then in 1962, for the first time, and a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, he wrote both music and lyrics, and shortly thereafter decided to, from that time forward, only to accept requests for writing both. On today's program, you'll hear his songs, among others, I Wish I Could Forget You and Send in the Clowns. Now we'll join Marianne as she reminisces with him at the beginning of the show.
I remember going to see one of your shows, A Little Night Music, and it just seems like yesterday, though.
It was 1973, but here it is, 21 years later.
21 years later.
Yeah.
Well, of course, I'm dying to pop the question about the new show that you're working on, what it's called and everything, everything. Tell me.
Okay, well, it's called Passion, and it's based on a novel of 1869. It's never been translated in English, published in Italy, written by a man named Tarchetti. Died at a very early age, and it was called Fosca, F-O-S-C-A, which is what we wanted to call it, but unfortunately it sounds too much like Tosca, and so we had no choice.
Yeah.
It was made into a wonderful movie, which is how I became aware of it. It was released in 1981, and I saw it at the film festival here, which is called Passione d'Amore, directed by Ettore Scola. And I've only twice in my life, or at least in my professional life, since West Side Story, I've only had two ideas that I just wanted to make into a musical. One was Sweeney Todd, which I saw at a little theater outside of London in a small production. And this, the minute I saw the movie, I wanted to make a musical of it.
Well, what's the storyline?
It's I don't sort of want to give it all away, but it's essentially a triangle. It's about a soldier in the Italian army who's stationed in Milan in 1869. He's very handsome, and he's having an affair with a very beautiful married woman. And he gets posted to a frontier post north of Italy. The commandant has a cousin. They're only men on the post, except one woman. The commandant has a cousin who is in her late 20s and who you don't meet for a while, but who's a very clear offstage presence, and she's very strange. And they meet, and I think I will not tell you what happens.
I was just going to say, do you seem like you told a hell of a
very,
lot already?
It's very spooky. That's a setup. But anyway, it's about a man and two women.
Well, you know,
essentially about a triangle.
I don't know if you feel like doing this already, but it sure would be great to hear something from the show.
Think sure. The song is takes place about 45 minutes into the show, and it's a ballad. And I should warn you before I play this that I don't always sing on pitch, and I sometimes play in the cracks. But I have to have the music in front of me. So if you hear a page turn, you'll hear a page turn. So I'll
dying
read from
to hear it.
I'll
Go
try.
Ahead.
I'll try.
I wish I could forget you, erase you from my mind. But ever since I met you, I find I cannot leave the thought of you behind. That doesn't mean I love you. I wish that I could love you. I know that I've upset you. I know I've been unkind. I wanted you to vanish from sight, but now I see you in a different light. And though I cannot love you, I wish that I could love you, for now I'm seeing love like none I've ever known. A love as pure as breath, as permanent as death, implacable as stone. A love that like a knife has cut into a life I wanted left alone. A love I may regret, but one I can't forget. I don't know how I let you so far inside my mind, but there you are and there you will stay. How could I ever let you away? I see now I was blind. And should you die tomorrow, another thing I see, your love will live in me.
You know, that's a beautiful song, and I'm sort of wondering, when you're writing a new song, how you put it together. Do you sit at the piano, or do you...
Well, that's interesting. I used to do that much more than I do now. Over the years, I've tried to work more and more away from the piano so that the scores would take on different colors. I, of course, don't work entirely away from the piano, and particularly when I'm making piano copy and deciding on refinements and where the chords, you know, what should be doubled in a chord.
Yeah, boy, you like some really spare kind of accompaniments, don't you?
Well, I'm getting into that now. You see, I used to write too many notes, and Jonathan Tunick, who has orchestrated most of my shows, has pointed out to me, you know, that because the piano is my instrument, that I should trust the sustaining power of other instruments more. And in other words, if I write a whole note, I immediately put another whole note in the next bar, because it never occurs to me the violin could hold it for 6 hours. So I'm constantly, you know, or putting my foot on the sustaining pedal, or writing arpeggios to keep the harmony going. Whereas, you know, if you think orchestrally, and, you know, scores are orchestral, it's different. So I'm trying to write sparer that way. Also, I think every young composer starts out with too much anything, including notes. Less is more is one of my favorite, you know, artistic things. But you have to grow into less is more. No, I don't think anybody starts out less is more.
Where did you hear your first music? With your parents in New York?
Isn't that funny? I guess the answer is, will surprise you. I was very precocious as a kid, verbally. And I learned to read at a very early age. And one of my showing offs was that I would read the New York Times to my first grade class aloud. And I didn't understand half the words I was reading,
but I could read.
And one of the ways my parents told me that I got interested in words was looking at the labels of records. I can actually remember, I don't have a very good childhood memory, but I do remember seeing a 12-inch record, you know, these were 78s, with a red label on it, and reading Ain't Misbehavin'. I remember reading the label and having no idea what the words meant.
I was taught
to read by sound, you see, the old school of reading where you pronounce the vowels and the consonants. You may not know what the word is, but I recognized Ain't Misbehavin'. Everybody thought, oh, isn't he great, he can read. I couldn't read. I could read the sounds. Then I took the obligatory 2 years of piano lessons when I was six, you know, which is what every nice upper middle class kid on the West Side did. And I would be trotted out at the end of the day and play Flight of the Bumblebee or something like that, and then trotted back in my bedroom for the company would come. But that didn't interest me very much. And I got reinterested in music. I went to military school when I was 10, and I was fascinated by the organ. They had the second biggest pipe organ in New York State. Only Radio City was bigger. And I took one look at all those manuals, and I mean, it was a great gadget. I'm a big gadget fan. So I took a year of organ there. I literally had to sit on the edge of the seat for my feet to touch the pedals, but I just loved doing it. And I played things like To a Wild Rose. But the fun was to press the blue buttons and the red buttons and the green buttons.
That's wild.
And that was that. And then when I was 15, as you probably know, when my parents got divorced, I went to live with my mother in Pennsylvania, and our neighbors, nearby neighbors, 3 miles away, were the Hammerstein family, Oscar Hammerstein, his family, and his son was my age, and we became very close friends and sort of spent our teens together, and I gradually osmosed in the Hammerstein household, and that's how I got interested in writing
osmosed.
Songs.
Yes, well, I love that. That's a great news. Yeah,
it was, and it was just the time he just started to write with Richard Rodgers. It was, you know, in the early 40s in Oklahoma. And so, and he became a surrogate father for me. And so I've often stated that if he'd been a geologist, I would probably have been a geologist. I just want to be what he was. But the fact is that I hit a gold mine. I hit a, you know, because he became my mentor and tutor in writing songs and taught me a great deal. So I went back to take piano lessons. And that's when I went to a school called the George School, in a Quaker school in Pennsylvania. And that's when I got interested more interested in writing music. So when I went to Williams College, I majored in music. We had a tiny music department, but the teacher happened to be wonderful. It was a two-man music department, but the man changed my life because he taught music in a totally unromantic way. It was, you know, I used to think that the muse would come and visit you at midnight and sit on your shoulder and she'd whisper in your ear and you go da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, whatever it is that you do. And he talked entirely about compositional techniques and leading tones and species counterpoint and all of that. And it was wonderful because I have that kind of puzzle mind.
This was before Milton Barrow.
Oh, yeah. That was this. This man's name was Robert Barrow. And so I majored in music, and I got a scholarship, a prize called the Hutchinson Prize, which sustained me for 2 years living in New York when I got out of school, allowed me to take to study music, and I did with Milton Babbitt, who is, and even then, was the avant-gardist avant-garde composer, but
yes,
who had a particular interest and has a particular interest in show music and jazz.
God, imagine getting to work with a guy like
And what we did was, which was wonderful, we would spend the first hour dissecting De Silva, Brown, and Henderson, and the next 3 hours dissecting Beethoven.
So you've got both sides.
Exactly.
You've got
and everything. His point was that the compositional techniques are exactly the same, whether you're writing a three-minute piece or an hour piece, and they are. And we would, I can still, and I had a class at, I taught at Oxford a few years ago, a seminar for musical theater students, and I repeated, and I remembered it so well, his analysis of All the Things You Are, which is, you know, some of Kern's forms are extraordinary, and that may be the only song in which the tonic is never stated until
Do
the last
play
chord.
That tune?
I used to, but I don't anymore, and his harmony is so subtle, I wouldn't do it. You know, he's one of the few guys who makes a distinction between the kind of vamp that goes and the kind that goes. Whether you have the seventh, whether you have the third in the bass or the fifth in the bass, that's the kind of thing he does. And that's what Milton kept pointing out to me, so I wouldn't play it. But if you study All the Things You Are, it starts in the relative minor, ends up in the major, but it never states the tonic.
I never knew that. Let me just play about
please.
10 bars.
Play all of it, please. Great tune, but you know it's a regular AABA form, and only in passing does it. I learned it in A flat. That's the only time, and even there you've got the seventh in it. But everything else, and it's also a circle of fifths. But the fifths break when he does the tritone, and it's the defining tritone of the keys coming from the keys going to. It goes on and on. And I asked Milton, I said, you mean he thought of all these things while he's writing this, what seems like a, you know, a tune that just comes out of nowhere?
Just falls in.
Yeah. He said, no, he said, it's like learning to drive a stick shift car. You get the technique, and it's in you forever and ever. Once you've learned the technique, you are applying it all the time. I remember I was talking to Dick Rogers about People Say We're in Love, and I said, you know, it's so wonderful the way the release of that is the inversion of the main tune, you know, don't throw bouquets at me, and the release goes, dum ba da da da. And
he
said,
he
never thought of it himself. He said, I'm sorry you told me. But you see, it was innate. I mean, because it came from inside. It's the inversion. Da ba ba. The inversion it. Da 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 da. Da da. It just turns it upside down.
Amazing.
And absolutely. And these things then become a kind of second nature. Although Oscar told me, Hammerstein, because you know he wrote a lot with Kern, including All the Things You Are, that he would be sitting in a room writing a lyric, and in the next room he'd hear something. I'm obviously making this up, but this is the idea. Go through every conceivable note, and once he'd decide on that one, he'd go on to the next one. So these tunes,
wow,
that sound as if they were written, you know, in a breath, mm-hmm, where it's like E.B. White's writing. It sounds so simple, but it takes him 3 days to compose a paragraph.
Well, of course, you pretty much started your career writing with these great people, Julie Stein and
Oh, yeah,
well,
I started as a lyric writer, because Oscar was a lyric writer.
And Richard Rodgers.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I mean, you obviously were, it was so wonderful to be living there or being like a surrogate son for Oscar Hammerstein. I mean, that really got you off to a good...
Well, it was wonderful because I learned from him techniques of writing lyrics and structure of plays and structure of scenes, structure of song. And then when the first composer I worked with, outside of my own music, was Leonard Bernstein, and from him learned a whole other way of thinking about music, you know. I tend to be kind of square in terms of like a bar structure, and you know, 4/4, 4/4. In fact, when I worked with Richard Rodgers, it was a shock because I would give him a sketch and sometimes sketch out the rhythm of the music, and the first thing he would do before looking at the rhythm is count the bars and be sure they were divisible by 4.
Well, now Leonard Bernstein.
And from Lenny, you're lucky if you can divide it by 7, you know, because that's the whole point, is to keep the listener surprised. And I learned that from him, and I think it doesn't necessarily make for big hit songs, and certainly Lenny wrote some standard form songs.
Well, you have never worried about writing big hit songs.
No, because I grew up in an era, luckily, where... Actually, Rodgers and Hammerstein, who had all those hits, they're the ones who killed that whole thing. And then rock came in. And when rock and pop came in the 50s, A, no subject matter was any more taboo. And secondly, Broadway was no longer the fount of pop songs. So you could do anything you wanted because you didn't have to care about it anymore. The number of hit songs that have come from Broadway in the last 20 years, you can count on one hand. And so you don't have to worry about it.
Oh,
now,
boy.
It doesn't make for hits, but on the other hand, it totally releases you. And... So I know I don't have to worry about it. I do remember, however, when I was writing Gypsy with Julie Stein, and I wrote a song, wrote a lyric called Small World, mm-hmm, and had a line in it, you're a man who likes children, that's an important sign. Funny, I'm a woman with children. And Julie said, but that means only a woman can sing it. In other words, even though he was certainly as concerned as we were that the song should fit, we being Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book, and I, even though he was as concerned as we were that the song should fit the situation and fit the character, he wanted to be sure it had a pop possibility. Well, that was late 50s. I don't think come mid-60s anybody cared about that anymore.
Oh, I'm sure they don't.
Because it doesn't do you any good. Songs for the last 30 years have been created by the artists who write them and sing them.
Well, one of your nicest songs, for me anyway, one of your loveliest songs was one from Anyone Can Whistle. Now, that was
an experimental show that ran only 9 performances.
Really?
Yeah. Could I ask you to play it?
I've never played it in public. This is
I wouldn't mind, if you don't mind doing it for a radio audience.
I'd love to do it.
I had a feeling you knew it.
Well, here goes.
Thank you. Thank you. terrific. You played it very tenderly, and really, I found that very touching.
Well, it's a very tender song, and I think I read somewhere that that's one of your favorite things that you ever wrote.
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact. Too many people make too much out of the fact that it's supposed to be about me, but in fact it was about the heroine played by Lee Remick. It was a character invented by Arthur Lawrence, but it has, the lyric has a number of, I think, things in it that are true of a lot of people.
It's true, absolutely. And by the way, on the record, I mean, I don't know how many performers have actually recorded the song, but I've heard a few who've done that song, but I really, for my part, I thought Lee Remick sang it better than anybody else I've heard.
I'll tell you, that generally turns out to be true of show music. Usually the original performer, even if they don't have the technique or the voice of subsequent records, generally turn out to be the best. It's partly because some of the songs are, in a sense, tailored, if not for the performer, for the character the performer plays. A good example is Send in the Clowns, which I wrote for Glynis Johns during the rehearsals of A Little Night Music, because I got to know her voice, and Hal Prince, who directed it, wanted her to have something to sing in the second act. And she was not primarily a singer, but she had a nice, silvery, clear, girlish voice, and she couldn't sustain notes very well. So what I did was I wrote a song composed of short phrases. Well, now, it's been beautifully sung by many people, including Judy Collins and Frank Sinatra,
yes,
who together made it famous.
Judy, she did a job.
But somehow it sits with Glynis better than any of them, and it's because of that, I think.
Oh, I'm having just a wonderful afternoon, and I hope all of you listening are enjoying this as much as I am. My guest is Stephen Sondheim. I'm Marian McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz. Well, you know, you got into Send in the Clowns, and that's one I did play and even record.
Really?
Yeah. As I played Send in the Clowns, I sort of seemed to get further and further away from
them.
That's
fine.
So,
please.
Maybe I can...
I'd love to. Yeah, please, improvise away. Improvise away.
All right, here, go on. Thank you.
wish I thought of that suspension at the end of the release back in 1972. That was terrific.
Well, it's I think I recorded it in...
Played in the original key again. You have a,
did I? Was that
E major. That's
key?
What I wrote it in, yeah. That's what I wrote it in. Actually, it's not the key it's printed in, but it's the key I wrote it in. And you pick it up mostly by ear, or do you read it off the sheet?
That's just it, Steve. I'm a terrible reader.
Well, you say terrible, but you could, I mean, if you're at home, you can certainly just look at the chords, pick them out, and get them into your fingers,
slowly.
And then think, hey, this would be nice if I did that.
Oh, it takes me an awful long time. But the way I learn something best is hearing somebody else's recording of it, and then maybe having the music.
Well, I'm glad. I don't know which recording you heard, because the funny thing is, there is a constant wrong chord in Sending the Clowns, because Nelson Riddle made a mistake in the Frank Sinatra recording. And so, and you didn't play the wrong chord, so that means you didn't pick that up from...
Actually, I saw the show, I loved the show, and I think I did originally... I have the sheet music, and I think I did.
Oh, the sheet music is correct.
But then I sort of deviated as I played.
That's fine, but the crucial chord you played, which is at the
which is the
release,
crucial chord. Da
da da da da da da da da da da da. Sure, my mind. And it's the middle of the release. No, middle of the release. Keep going. Keep going. It's the end of the next phrase. That's it. The suspension in there, he did not put in.
Well,
he put the third in instead of the suspension.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can hear it on the record. And the result is because so many people have picked it up from the Sinatra record. Judy Collins' record is correct, but Sinatra's is incorrect. It's a wonderful recording. And actually, Sinatra re-recorded it, and I wrote Nelson Riddle. I said, would you correct it? And he didn't correct it. He didn't correct it
on
the second
go-round. Well, that stinker. Now he can't.
No, I know. But it was fascinating to me because I didn't know enough about pop records to realize that most of the records that have been made of that song were made by somebody transcribing from the Sinatra record rather than going back to the sheet music.
I'm curious. Did Barbara Streisand, she really wanted that extra verse?
Well, she made a good point, curiously enough. That song, which was hardly thought of as a hit. In fact, it took 2 years before anybody made a record.
Again, we're talking about
Sending the Clowns, right? Yeah. It was, it was a one chorus, and then the man to whom she's sung the chorus has a monologue, which lasts maybe 2 minutes, and then he leaves, and then she sings a second half chorus of regret that it's not going to work out. When Streisand came to this, she said, I don't get the connection between the first chorus and the second. I said, that's because there isn't any. There's a monologue missing. She was approaching it as an actress. She said, isn't there a way you could bridge it? I said, well, let me see if I can write another release that would get us from the emotional state of the first one to the emotional state of the second one. So I thought it was a pretty legitimate request.
I just wondered about that.
Absolutely. I would not have done it if I didn't think it made sense.
Yeah, well, I imagine you wouldn't, but I thought...
No, I really wouldn't.
Imagine
people
doing that under
duress. It's unfair to Barbara. They think of her as this, complete martinet, and anybody will do anything she wants, and that I did it because I wanted to please her. Not at all, because I thought it was a perfectly legitimate request if you're going to do a song that's supposed to make dramatic sense.
You know what I loved was the song in Pacific Overtures, which I didn't see, unfortunately, but listening to it, Someone in a Tree...
Oh, yes.
Is that
That's generally if I have to answer, and I really don't like to, they say, what's your favorite song? I say, well, certainly among them is Someone in a Tree. I love that song a lot.
Then the next one after that was Sweeney Todd. God, I mean, we saw that, and of course I loved it. And I remember sitting there when the song came up, when he's in the guy's in the chair and the being shaved, and they're singing
women.
Beautiful song that has no connection.
I determined when I started that show that I was going to have one moment where the audience thought a murder was going to occur and it didn't, and another one where they had no idea it was going to occur and it suddenly did. And I thought the only way to do that is disarm them with ballads. So in the second act, when he's singing a song called Joanna, and he suddenly, in the middle of this pretty melody, slashes somebody's throat, the entire audience freaks out because it's breaking the rules. You're not allowed to kill somebody. But the ballad you're talking about, Pretty Women, he doesn't kill the man.
I think a lot of people play that. I was talking to Barbara Carroll the other day. She loves that song.
Oh, yeah?
I'd like to try and
play that. Oh, could you?
Play that one.
Please.
You know, this song does have sort of what we would consider jazz harmony.
Yeah, it does indeed.
Or where it goes.
But it's over a pedal.
Well, it's somehow it works.
Great. Great cadences, great cadences. Do you always play with your left foot on the sustaining pedal? I've never
yes,
seen that before.
Yes, I don't.
Is that since a kid?
No, you know what? I think Duke Ellington did that to me because...
he stomped with the right foot?
No, years ago I used to watch him, and I got to know him very well. I guess he was a big influence on me. When he would play, it was real showbiz. He would turn around and smile at the audience, and he always had his left foot on the pedal because this way
that
you
way
could turn around and be show businessy.
My goodness.
So when I started out with my trio, I guess I thought I would do that too, to a certain extent.
Sure.
So I would play sort of...
But then what happens when you want to play soft?
I don't know. I can achieve it. I just play soft.
Right.
In fact, I think I play soft better without the soft pedal than with, which is probably...
I find I use the soft pedal less and less, although I tend to pound, particularly when I'm writing, I tend to pound.
But you know, you can achieve a certain delicate touch just by thinking good thoughts or something like that.
That's true.
You can
that's
really,
absolutely right.
And, of course, if you have a decent piano.
That's true.
That helps achieve so many more things. Well, for those of you who have just tuned in, we're just having a marvelous time here. And my guest is Stephen Sondheim. I'm Marian McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz. You know, to me, Sweeney Todd is like almost an opera. Have you ever thought about doing a fully-fledged, fully-blown opera?
I've been approached a number of times. In fact, I was flattered just yesterday to be approached by the Vienna State Opera.
Wow.
But I'll tell you what the problem with an opera is. The real problem is that
shows, musical shows anyway, have to be rewritten in front of an audience. An audience is the eventual collaborator. An opera is something that sort of comes fully grown out of the pod. And even if a composer wants to fiddle with it, rewrite it, he gets no chance to. Opera companies cannot run a new opera for 2 or 3 weeks, night after night, with the same cast, which is the only way you can possibly judge a work and see whether you want to rewrite something or not. When Beverly Sills asked me to write, and she pressed me quite hard, and she's a good presser, for the City Opera, I said, if you'll give me 2 weeks of uninterrupted performances with the same cast, because you can't, as they do with operas, you can't have, you know, one lady playing Mrs. Lovett one night and another lady playing Mrs. Lovett the next night and judge whether the song is at fault or whether the lady's at fault. And so it's an impracticality to improve an opera. And I think that's the major reason why most 20th century operas, most, and certainly in the latter half of the 20th century, aren't very good. They may be full of good things, but the composers never get a chance to work on them. And whereas perhaps its ambitions are less, but shows in the musical theater tend, particularly in the last 25 years with the whole workshop system, to be worked on and worked on and worked on and worked on.
Didn't you have a big success with Follies?
Well, no, it was a financial failure, but it was partly because it was a genuinely spectacular show with a cast of 53, which in those days...
I'd love to have seen that.
It was wonderful. Yes, and unfortunately there's no record of it. You know, since 1970, the Lincoln Center Library of Performing Arts has been taping Broadway shows, both musicals and plays, and off-Broadway, too.
No
visual record of it.
Well, one of my favorite tunes, really, is one of your songs from Follies, and it's a gorgeous ballad, Losing My Mind. Okay, can I do that?
Oh, yeah, that'd be wonderful, yeah. I like that a lot.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's a great tune.
And that's the kind of tune I would think that lends itself very well to kind of improvisation. And
it does. It does. I mean, I have to confess I haven't got into it, but I will. Mm-hmm. I will get into that because...
Yeah, that's the kind of chord structure I would think would work.
No, that's a good... Well,
anyways.
Okay. So much more. Well, you know, there's some lovely things from... Merrily We Roll Along. How did that... What
that was another point. We're going to do that again. That's coming up very soon. We're
oh,
doing
good.
Another production at the York Theater. And George Firth, who wrote the book, and I have rewritten it three times. Not entirely. Mostly in the first 20 minutes. And I also added some. We did... It was a failure on Broadway. It was cast wrong. We had a notion, Hal Prince and I, to cast it with kids, because it's a story that goes backwards in time and takes very successful 40-year-old people and brings them back to their idealistic roots at the age of 18. And we thought, wouldn't it be a terrific idea to cast it with 18-year-olds, so they become realer and realer as the evening went on. When it was originally done as a straight play, written by Kaufman and Hart in the early 30s, it was done by actors, you know, around the age of 30, who both acted older and acted younger. It was a mistake to do it this way because there was a kind of, and it was deliberate, a kind of amateur feeling about the show. Hal wanted the thing to feel like something put on in a school gym. And I think that would have been okay if you'd done off-Broadway, but on Broadway, it just didn't seem right. And there were some other problems with the show, but I liked the show very much. And although it was a resounding failure, we got a terrific record out of it.
Did that song, Not a Day Goes By, was that sort of... That's a gorgeous song, but I mean, I'd love to try and play it.
I'd love to hear you try that.
I'm going to try that.
I like that a lot. It's interesting because I think the listeners should know you and I didn't consult about which songs you should do. I just came into the studio today, and the ones you're picking are the ones I like.
Oh, really?
So our tastes are similar. That's
well,
very nice.
I just tend to love romantic ballads and an unrequited love.
That's what this is.
And all those things.
That's exactly what this is.
Let's see. What else? Oh.
Carly Simon made a very nice record of this.
That's what I heard. I heard that in the car not so long ago. And actually, I had not heard anybody do it, and it absolutely stopped me cold. I almost pulled over to the side of the road. It's just a beautiful song, and I mean, the title, everything. It just really tells you everything. Not a day goes by.
That's good, yes.
So, here goes.
Good. You look surprised. You look surprised.
I love the song.
Sounds good.
I think it's a great song.
Good, thank you.
because that thing is so dramatic, actually. And I notice in the show it's like two sets of lyrics. Does it have a different...
Yes, well, see, the whole idea of the show, since it goes back in time, is that the things they sing in the first act take on different meanings in the second act when they're younger. So the first time you hear this song, it's a bitter song of recrimination by a wife who's been jilted by her husband. And then it turns out at the end of the second act that it's the song they got married to when it was full of hope and love. So that's the notion of the show, is that there are blocks of music and songs and titles and lyrics that take on different colors and different meanings as the show goes backwards in time, because, you know, it's about friendship.
See, well, being as I say, the romantic person I am, I tend to go with the sad lyrics. You know, I tend to.
Well, also it's the more dramatic of the two lyrics. There's no question about that.
Nobody could do it better. I've got to get that record because I was trying to think who did I hear do it, and of course it was Carly Simon. Mm. Well, fantastic. You know,
Bernadette Peters also sings it wonderfully. She sang it down.
Oh, that woman is unbelievable. I mean, the
it's a song that suits her very well because she attaches to the material very well. That kind of.
I should have mentioned other shows which I really didn't get into. I mean, Into the Woods, and you actually did a rap song there, didn't you? I mean,
a little rap, a kind of semi-rap passage, for the witch. Yes,
that's another interesting subject matter. You know, nursery rhymes, and then Surratt with a pointillistic.
Sunday in the Park with George, yeah.
You know, I just thought of something I'd meant to ask you earlier. What might be your favorite tune of tunes you didn't write and maybe wished you had written, like a favorite tune?
Gosh, there are a lot of them. One of them is Birth of the Blues.
Really?
Which is a song I adore. Another one is The Song Is You. It's a lot of current. And then I wish I'd written anything in Porgy and Bess, you know. There are three or four songs in Porgy. I mean, the whole score is.
I love you, Porgy.
Oh, please!
I love that. Well, we could go on.
And Bess, Where's My Bess? The trio at the end. It's a genuinely inspired piece, and I don't think anything has ever touched it or ever will touch it in musical theater in America. I really.
You know, Steve, we could go on like this forever. Maybe we could do Piano Jazz Part 2 some other time.
Okay.
But meanwhile, I mean, I only know it's a tip of the iceberg with you. I didn't get so many more things from you that I would like to talk about. But first, I want to thank you for being here and for giving such wonderful insight and information and funny stuff.
You know, it's my pleasure, and it's also wonderful to hear you play my songs. That's it's wonderful to hear you play them because I don't get that kind of treatment very often. It's nice.
They're
really
all
nice.
Wonderful, and I'm going to keep playing them. And I also haven't played one tune which I like a lot. Maybe we could end things with this Old Friends.
Oh, man.
I think that's a nice tune, and I first heard Barbara Carroll sing that, and
I
really love that.
Just heard a favorite from the Piano Jazz Archives from 1994 with Marian McPartland and her guest Stephen Sondheim. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio. The producer is Shari Hutchinson, recording engineer Andrew Milano, mastering engineer Bill Sexton, production coordinator Gene Pinkston. Executive Producer Tom Clark. We love to hear from you. Our email address is pj@scetv.org. Our postal address is 1041 George Rogers Boulevard, Columbia, South Carolina, 29201. To find out more about the artists and music selections on Piano Jazz, visit our website, pianojazz.npr.org.